Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.
Shri Bhakti Vedanta ki.
Jai.
Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki.
Jai.
Giriraj Maharaj ki.
Jai
Go Premanande. So what did we discuss in last week's class? Anything else?
And again, we see in Bhagavatam that people offending their devotees, they undergo a lot of trouble, like Daksha and Kaugana, Kadabharat, and then Indra, Bruhaspati. So these are some of the examples. And offending a devotee is the greatest offense, Patimata. Culmination of knowledge develops in humility. Nothing is impossible with the power of holy name. We have previously seen Ajamir in case of Ajamir, and also the last verse of 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam glorifies Harinam Sankirtan.
Some points. Good. Anything else?
And you must ask for forgiveness from the devotees whom you have offended, and Krishna will protect you. Oh.
Good. Any other points? Okay. So now we'll continue with chapter 6. So chapter 5 was discussing the pastime of who? Yeah, Devasa Muni Maharaj Ambari. So we heard at the end of the pastime. Now we'll go into chapter 6 and we'll begin to hear a description about the descendants of Manu. It described in the first chapter of the canto, Manu had 11 sons, I think it was, and we've heard about 10 of them descending from Manu. Now we're going to hear about Ikshvaku, who was mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. It said from Manu came Ikshvaku. And then the remainder of the chapter, which we'll get into. I don't think there'll be a class tomorrow night. Maharaj is doing bhajans in the temple.
Yes.
That's what it says, right? Okay. So tomorrow night, I don't think there'll be a class because Maharaj will be doing. But then next week, we'll continue the chapter and we'll hear about the pastime of Sabari Muni, which is another famous pastime from the ninth canto of the Bhagavad Gita. So tonight we'll do the first 25 verses of Canto 9, Chapter 6. The chapter is called The Downfall of Sabari Muni. Shukadev Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikshit, Ambarish had 3 sons named Virupa, Ketuman, and Shambhu. From Virupa came a son named Prisha Dashwa. And from Prishadashwa came a son named Ratitara. Ratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of this request, Angira begot sons in the room of Ratitara's wife. All these sons were born with Brahminical prowess. Okay. So we'll read the purport. Enjoy Jagannath. You like to read them.
In the Vedic age, a man was sometimes called upon to beget sons in the womb of a lesser man's wife for the sake of bitter progeny. In such an instance, the woman is compared to an agricultural field. A person producing an agricultural field may employ another person to produce food grains from it. But because the grains are produced from the land, they are considered the property of the owner of the land. Similarly, a woman was sometimes allowed to be impregnated. Yasoma other than her husband, but the sons born of her would then become her husband's sons. Such sons were called Setrijata. Because Matitara had no sons, he took advantage of this method.
So any points here?
Sexual intercourse. They could produce it just by the sight.
Where does it say that?
Well, this is what happened with the in the Kuru dynasty, you know, they had no children, and so Satyavati asked them to come.
Yeah, but it wasn't by sight. No, it wasn't like that. Any other points?
The previous canto also we were reading, and it was mentioned a person of a higher class should not, if he's been asked to progenate, he shouldn't deny, he should fulfill the desire of the lower class woman if she needs a son. So it was a custom in previous ages where men of a higher class do this kind of progenation for the better population.
Yeah. It was permissible. You're allowed. Something makes sense. Any other points?
See, the Pandu are the five children, the sons.
Five sons were
born with the sight too.
No, well, it's not mentioned they were just born by sight.
They just look at them.
Doesn't work like that. Awesome. Any other points? So it is mentioned, Lord Chaitanya is speaking to Chankazi, if you go into Chaitanya Charitamrita, and while Lord Chaitanya is speaking to Chankazi, he points out that the Islam religion, which the Chankazi was a part of, it is permissible within that religion to eat meat to some degree. But Lord Chaitanya, he points out that actually this is a concoction, that real religion, technically, you're not allowed to eat meat. There are very strict prohibitions for eating meat. You can eat, but it's very strict in what you can do, how you can eat. So, in that conversation between Chankazi and Lord Chaitanya, Lord Chaitanya quotes, because Chankazi says, it says within the Vedas that you can also eat meat. It is in the Quran, but it is also in the Vedas. But Lord Chaitanya says, and then he quotes a verse, and Lord Chaitanya says, but within this age of Kali, five things are forbidden. One is the Ashwamedha Yagya, which means killing the
horse,
the horse sacrifice. One is the cow sacrifice. One is the begetting the child within the womb of the
brother's wife,
and taking sannyas, and also offering oblations of flesh to the forefathers. So these five things are forbidden within the Kali Yuga. But in the Vedas it says that each of these things they may be permitted under certain circumstances. So killing the horse or killing the cow was there, but it was a controlled activity. And Prabhupada explains, and the Bhagavatam explains itself, this is the purpose of the incarnation of Lord Buddha, was to stop this animal sacrifice in the name of the Vedas. It is not permissible, according to the Vedas, to just sacrifice the animals without very strict prohibition, a very strict regulation. There is animal sacrifice there within the Vedas. And we'll see in this pastime, actually, in this chapter, animal sacrifice was there. All killing of animals was there, but under very strict regulation. It is not like these days where everything is unregulated. What is the nature of the age of Kali? Everything becomes unregulated, illicit, or uncontrolled. And people think that is natural or normal or acceptable or permissible. But according to the laws of God, everything must be regulated within human society. Now, what is the defect with the modern law system? The modern law system is arbitrary, which means it can change constantly. Right? It changes virtually every time there's a new political party. And even within the same political party, the laws are constantly changing. Whereas in the Vedic system, where do the laws come from for humanity? Yeah, from the scriptures. But which scriptures? Right, specifically for the Manu Samhita. So we're hearing here about the descendants of Manu. Right, we're about to hear about Ikshvaku, who is the descendant of Manu, according to the Gita. Right, Vivashvan spoke to Manu, spoke to Ikshvaku, and that's how it entered into humanity. So there was always a Manu, which means a guide for humanity, a father of mankind. Just like in biblical terms, in the Bible, it describes the original people in the creation were Adam and Eve, the first man, the first woman. In the Vedic system, the first progenitor is said to be Manu. Manu is a position in which one procreates to populate the universe. So he's called a progenitor. And the Bhagavatam, it is described back in the second canto, there are 10 subject matters in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And one of the subject matters is Manvantara, which means the Manus who will come. And so far since the third canto of the Bhagavatam, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th canto, we're hearing about the descendants of the Manvantars, or the Manus. So now we're hearing about Manu's descendants, his 10 sons, and in this particular chapter we hear about Ikshvaku. Now Manu, when he creates the universe, he also gives the laws for the universe. Just like the father in the family, technically he will instill the laws within the family, or keep law and order within the family. That is the father's responsibility. That is the king's responsibility. The Rajashi, or the leader of society. He is meant to keep all the laws within check, within society. So there is no deviation. So we see that Manu, he gives the Manu Samhita. These laws are not arbitrary. It's not that we change the Manu Samhita's laws after 1,000 years. Or after 10,000 years, or after 2 million years. We don't change it. These are the laws which are given for humanity, and they're unchangeable, because they're given by the representative of God himself. In the sixth canto, then, Yamaraj gives a list of 12 Mahajans. Brahma, Shiva, Narada, the Kumaras, Manu. Right? He says Manu, Kapila, and then he says Janak, Prahlad, Bhishma, all that. Yamaraj, Shuka, Bali, like that. So, Manu is one of the Mahajanas. So when he speaks, that becomes law for humanity. So, what is the law that he gives for murder? Right? If someone breaks the law in human society, if someone murders another person, then the law is that that person shall be accept capital punishment, or yeah, like that. That person is killed. You kill, then that is the law. Whereas these days, everything in every country is different. In Saudi Arabia, they may still do that. I think they still do that. In Singapore, I think they do that. There's a death penalty, like that. But in Australia, there's no death penalty. In America, there's no death penalty. In India, I don't think there's death penalty. Like that. Maybe after some time, but you know, they have these court cases and everything like that. So everything has become irregulated in Kali Yuga. Whereas the system previously was, there is a system. So it means you cannot eat meat unlawfully. Meat eating is given within the Vedas, but it's very strict. And Prabhupada will explain that in this chapter as we read through the purports. It's not unregulated. So these two things are forbidden in Kali Yuga. You cannot kill the cow, you cannot kill the horse in the sacrifice. Why? Because in the previous ages, when you killed the horse, you had to bring the horse back to life. When you killed the cow, you had to bring the cow back to life. That's no longer possible. Therefore, it is forbidden to do it as part of the Vedic sacrifice. And then it is said, do not take sannyas within the age of Kali. So that is confusing because Prabhupada gave many people sannyas. And we have a sannyasi staying upstairs right at the moment. And there's sannyasis all through ISKCON. So in Kali Yuga it says, do not take sannyas. That means there's a warning. It is very difficult to take sannyas in Kali Yuga. It is not an easy thing to do in Kali Yuga. One has to be highly qualified to do it in Kali Yuga. Prabhupada did give sannyas, but it was under very strict terms. Actually, the way Prabhupada did it was an emergency situation. Prabhupada said that himself. He said, just like when there's a war, then you have to just grab people to fight in the army. So then you just give someone. You say, okay, you're the captain. But the guy doesn't know anything about how to be a captain. But it's a war, so we need a captain. So okay, you're the captain. So suddenly you just became captain. But Prabhupada was also doing like that. He was saying, you take sannyas, you take sannyas. There was an emergency situation. But now in ISKCON, to take sannyas is not an easy thing. 5-year minimum waiting list. You have to get a recommendation from at least 10 or 12 senior devotees. You have to have GBC approval, sannyas minister approval, guru approval, your zonal council has to approve you. There's many stipulations. Now. It's not an easy thing. So generally, in Kali Yuga, it's not recommended to take sannyas. But we don't have to worry about that too much, because I don't think anyone here is thinking about it. Except maybe Jai Jagannath. Jai. But I don't think anyone else here is thinking about it. So this is the system. So do not slaughter the cow, do not slaughter the horse, do not take sannyas. Right? Did not offer oblations of flesh to the forefathers. That is mentioned. Right? Don't offer oblation of flesh. And that's actually mentioned in this chapter. It's very strict. It is there, and it's mentioned in this chapter. We'll see in the next few verses. It's there. Vishishta is given flesh to offer to the forefathers. There is some system there, but it's a very strict system. But these days, in Kali Yuga, everything becomes irregular, and as Prabhupada points out, flesh eating is just wholesale. It's not permitted in human society. In human society, Prabhupada explains in the next few purports, he says it is under regulation. If flesh eating is there, it is regulated. Right? There are four things when we take our vows in ISKCON that we are asked to do. No meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. All those four things in the Vedic civilization, they were heavily regulated. Illicit sex is regulated. It's not that anyone can just have illicit sex. There is prohibition. Right? There is regulation on sex life. That is there in the Vedic scriptures. Then there is eating meat. It is regulated. Not that anyone can just go and eat any animal they want or any flesh they like, or kill an animal. It's not systematically done like that. It is not permitted like that. Gambling was also there. But gambling was not also an open thing. It was a regulated thing. And intoxication was also there. But intoxication was also regulated. It wasn't just anyone could go and take intoxication. Now, specifically of the four varnas, it is mentioned the kshatriyas, they had license for those four things. Some illicit sex was there, some intoxication was there, some gambling was there, some meat eating was there. All those four things were there. But even that was very regulated. They couldn't just do whatever they wanted, whenever they wanted. So that's the nature of the age of Kali. People just do whatever they want, whenever they want. So here, it is specifically mentioned, do not beget child in the womb of the brother's wife. In Kali Yuga, that is not permitted. In previous yugas, it could be permitted. But all that was also regulated. It means under certain circumstances, especially in the dynasties, where the dynasty had to continue with the kings, the kshatriyas, then these things were permitted. But it wasn't just any time, anywhere like that. In Kali Yuga, all of these things become corrupted and polluted. Any points?
Australia, they had some rules and regulations in killing animals, and for example, life for you. And they hunt only then for food and not for...
Not for sport. Yeah. Any other points?
I was just wondering when they were sacrificing goats in front of Mother Kali to eat. Both the goats, she had another birth again, or she was just dead?
No, was it's not.
Reborn, no?
No, the animal was dead.
She was not reborn again.
In the Vedic culture, they would bring the cow or the horse back to life, the brahmana. But if some sudra is just sacrificing the goat in front of the statue of Kali, he doesn't have the potency to bring the animal back to life. So
that was done by the sudras.
Brahmanas don't usually sacrifice goats. So it's... Anything else? Yeah, Prabhupada said like that. They get an old animal, sacrifice the old animal, and then when they chant the mantra, it would get a young body. So it was a good deal.
Why did they used to do human sacrifice?
Human? Where is that?
Well, I was reading about Vishwamitra, and I think somebody wanted to sacrifice human sacrifice, and then he got the son somehow back.
I don't know the details. I've heard something, but I don't know the details.
I think that was in the Rajchandra. He wanted to. He got the son from Kubera, and he promised that he would sacrifice his son.
The Rakshasas used to sacrifice the, how do you call it, the human beings. Rakshasas used to, it's part of their culture. It's not part of a Vedic, it's not a Vedic sacrifice.
That was related to Harishchandra and Vishwamitra. He got some work.
Yeah, I don't know the details of the story. Anything else?
In India, there used to be two types of worshippers. One is Vamayana and one is Dakshinayana. Vamayana is the left hand method, which is one of the things is sacrificing humans to Kali, black magic.
Yeah, it's not a Brahminical activity. We don't do it in this one. Yeah, it's not Brahminical. It's Rakshasa. Rakshasas do that. They kill human beings. South America, they used to do it. Not that, about a couple hundred years ago, they were doing it. The Aztecs and the Mayans, they would sacrifice human beings. It's a Rakshasa activity. It's not a... Not Brahminical.
That's right, because he wanted to do for Jabharat as well.
Yeah, Jabharat, yeah, they were trying. They were dacoits, they were like shudras. Don't like that. So. Okay. Don't anyone in this room should not do it. Having been born from the womb of Ratihara's wife, all these sons were known as the dynasty of Ratihara. But because they were born from the semen of Angira, they were also known as the dynasty of Angira. Among all the progeny of Ratihara, these sons were the most prominent because, owing to their birth, they were considered Brahmanas. Jim, when would you like to read?
Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura gives the meaning of Dvi Jataya as a mixed caste, indicating a mixture of Brahmana and Kshatriya.
What is the point? Chaturvanyam Maya Shishtam Guna Kama Vibhagashaha. Krishna says in the Gita, you have to understand someone's proclivity based on guna and karma, not by janma. So even though they were born within the Kshatriya womb, but they were considered brahmana because of quality. So you see, when the children grow up, you'll see their proclivity. You can't say just because someone is born in that family, they are that. Generally, it's like that. Generally, Shudras give birth to Shudras, Vaishyas give birth to Vaishyas, Kshatriyas to Kshatriyas, and Brahmanas to Brahmanas, generally. But sometimes there's changing of caste. So you have to see according to the consciousness of the individual, not by the birth. In Kali Yuga, it doesn't matter so much anyway. Yeah, generally samskaras are performed by the higher castes. Sudras, that's one of the features that denotes them as sudra.
In Kali Yuga, I'm saying that even though most of the sudras are still performed in Kavaram samskara, then we can
give birth to a demigod.
Or at least a
demigod. Yeah. Yeah, I saw some demigods running around the car park before. Because who was his father?
Vyasadeva.
And who was he?
Yamaraj.
Yeah, Yamaraj. Took birth as Vidura. Like that. So, his qualities were not ordinary. Like that. But his father was a Brahmana. So. And because the mother was in purified consciousness, even though she's like Shudrani, like a Sudra woman, because the consciousness was purified, then she became elevated. Yeah, so it means what is the quality of the both parents at time of conception?
Consciousness.
Yeah. So it's very important what is the consciousness of the woman. You can't just put all the responsibility onto the man. That's the problem in Kali Yuga, the men get all the responsibility. You know, when the child doesn't turn out right, they say it was your problem. But the Bhagavatam, the Vedic scriptures say it is equally both parties. But the men always get the... That is the problem. The son of Manu was Ikshvaku. When Manu was sneezing, Ikshvaku was born from Manu's nostrils. King Ikshvaku had 100 sons, of whom Vikukshi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the most prominent. Raj, would you like to read them?
According to Sridhar's Swami, although the Bhagavatam 9.1.11-12 has previously included Ikshvaku among the 10 sons begotten by Manu and his wife Shraddha, this was a generalization. It is here specifically explained that Ikshvaku was born simply from the sneezing of Manu.
Any points?
First one is about Brahma's nostril.
Any other points?
we see that in Kali Yuga, sex life, you know, everything is quite gross in Kali Yuga, but in the earlier ages there were different methods of begetting children, even from nostrils children can be produced. Kali Yuga is so gross. Prabhupada says no sex life is the thing which keeps. You can see that in Kali Yuga, that's the most important thing. That's what can only beget children.
In the previous age, this is not a common thing. It wasn't the people just walking around just going, no, I'm just like. Yeah, it wasn't like during winter, it was just like kids going. It's very uncommon thing. It's like, you know, a very rare thing. But who would actually believe this? Hands up if you actually believe this. Someone can give birth out of the nostril. Right? You really think about it. Think about it very carefully. Right? Imagine this. Someone like, and then suddenly, you know? Is it a boy or is it a girl? Like, it's not ordinary. It's not ordinary. No? So these things are actually a test of faith. Really. Because if... You know, you go down Dank Street, knock on any door and start reading this to them. Yeah, in our scriptures it says that Ikshvaku's son was born from Ikshvaku was born from Manu's nostril. You know, it's very, very extraordinary stuff. Right? Right. We think the world is crazy. You know, but you can understand why people think the Hare Krishna movement is crazy. No, because the stuff, the things that are here, it's very extraordinary descriptions. Yeah, and we actually believe this. You actually believe this. So this means that, you know, this is not ordinary. You know, to think that a child will just come from a nostril. Or in Canto 3, then a boar comes from a nostril. And then grows and takes up the whole universe. Like that. Or in the end of the previous canto, you know, someone got a fish. Right? And the fish, how did the fish appear? Matsya.
Oh,
water.
Took it like out of the river, and then the fish, then you put it back, and then the fish got bigger and bigger and then larger, and then you had to put it, and then it ended up taking up the universe, this fish. So these are very extraordinary things. So these are the test of faith. And actually there is that famous story where the cobbler and the brahmana, they meet Narada. And they said, Narada, where are you going? He says, I'm going to see Vishnu. And both of them say, can you please ask when I will go back to Lord Vishnu? And then Narada goes to see Lord Vishnu, he comes back. And then they both ask him. The brahmana says, what was Lord Vishnu doing? He said, he had the elephant. He's putting the elephant through the eye of the needle. Like that. And the Brahmin said, that is not possible. And then he said, how long will it take until I go back? And he said, Lord Vishnu said, it will take you many lifetimes. And he went to the cobbler and said, what was the Lord doing? He said, he put the elephant through the eye of the needle. And the cobbler said, that is amazing. My Lord can do these things. When will I go back to Godhead? And he said, you will go back at the end of this life. So it is Shraddha, it is faith. All these things in the Bhagavatam are tests of faith. Do you actually believe that the children come from the nostrils or the boars come from the nostrils and all these things? You say you're believed. So that's a test of faith, which is one of the 12 aims of our study. Faith and conviction. Now if we have Shraddha, faith, then you go back to the spiritual world. If you don't have Shraddha, then you stay in this material world.
Hanumanji going from Lanka to give the message back to Lord Rama.
Was on the way across.
I think so. And then he sweat. So there was a few drops on, and the crocodile rather than sheep begots her son. Although Hanumanji is a brahmachari. So it shows that like every aspect of a pure devotee is, like we just said, I mean, just by sneezing or by sweat or, I mean, so different ways.
Yeah, build a bridge made of rocks. Yeah, the army's made of monkeys. Yeah, everything about our religion is quite extraordinary, actually. There's only two conclusions. Either we're crazy, or the rest of the world is crazy.
How was Prabhupada and her brother in the
passage? Out of the fire. That's another thing that happened. They chanted mantras and then a chariot came out of the fire. The chariot came out with a warrior on the chariot who was born to kill Drona. And then Draupadi came out of a fire, walked out of a fire. So these things happened previously. Not like they were happening every day, but these things were happening previously.
I think there was one son born from grandma's nostril.
Yeah. Shiva came from between his eyes. Rudra. And Shiva came like that, appeared. So, yeah, very amazing things.
So, why is it that suddenly Sukadeva Goswami has digressed to this topic? No, I'm not able to understand the connection between verse 3 and 4. You were talking about Radhiyara and the descendants of Ambarish Maharaj, and why suddenly about Manu we are discussing now?
Because Ambarish had three sons. Yeah, so it's backtracking a little bit. It's backtracking. It's going back to the first chapter where it describes Manu's 11 sons, I think it was. It's 10 or 11. And describes one of those 11 sons was Ikshvaku. And it describes back then in chapter 1, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that they were all born, but then specifically it says in this verse that he was born from the nostril. So it's going back a little bit. It's kind of backtracking to chapter 1. Because it wasn't fully described. All the detail was not given there. So now he's given the detail of how Ikshvaku appeared. And it says that he's described the other, from chapter 1, there's been like a brief description of the other 10 sons. And now Ikshvaku will be described a little more. That's the connection. Like that. It's very technical. If you read through this, I mean, there's a lot of names and, you know, it's very hard to follow the thread. But basically, it's the population of the universe coming from Manu.
I thought it was Eva who and after she gave up everything and retired from the world, then he got 10 sons. Now, first she became the wanted a son, but she became the daughter, and then, you know, just turn around, and then after she did all the, you know, the looked after the kingdom and everything, and after she went to forest, then he wanted, he got 10 sons. Later on.
Yeah, the general principle is you have your children, then you go to the forest, generally.
Yeah, but when Ida retired.
Yeah, I know. And they met the, was it the moon?
Yeah.
Yeah. Daughter of the moon god. Yeah, it's very technical, like the whole, it's all the dynasty being described. A lot of this canto is the dynasty being described, because it's leading up to the appearance of Ram in this canto, and then Krishna in the next canto. So it's a lot of genealogical information, which you'll have to remember for your exam.
Okay, Lord Rama was born in the dynasty of Ikshvaku.
Yeah, the sun god. This is leading to Lord Rama's appearance. Of the 100 sons, 25 became kings in the western side of Aryavarta, a place between the Himalaya and the Vindhya Mountains. After 25 sons became kings in the east of Aryavarta, and the three principal sons became kings in the middle, the other sons became kings in various other places. So where are the Himalaya?
North.
Are they still there? Yeah, they're in India. If you fly from Calcutta to Delhi, sometimes you can see them. Himalaya?
What mountain?
Big mountains, right? And where is the Vindhya? They're still called Vindhya. The name is still Vindhya.
Central-ish,
yeah. Central, if you look on the map, it's central kind of India. So southern central.
Maharashtra.
Okay, so there's a mountain range there. So in between those two places, which is basically north in India, which is called Golda Desh. We're called Gaudiya Vaishnavas. What does Gaudiya Vaishnava mean? Yeah, we're from Golda Desh. Yeah, not in Bengal, but that whole northern tract of India. A lot of people think when we say we're Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they think it means we're from Lord Chaitanya, Gaura. But it's Gaudiya means that there's five states in the Vedic system in that northern part of India, between Vindhya Mountain and the Himalaya, like that. So that in that part of India, you'll see the worship of the Lord is different. If you go to the southern part of India, which is called Panchagolda, which is this five states down there, traditionally speaking, the mood of worship is very different. The southern worship and the northern worship are quite different. In the northern worship, Radha Krishna and Sita Ram, they're the principal deities. If you go to northern India, you don't find many Vishnu temples. Right? It's all Radha Krishna, Sita Ram, like that, generally. Lakshmi Narayan maybe, but generally like that. But if you go down to southern India, generally, you won't find Radha Krishna. Very rare to find Radha Krishna in the south. And you won't find Sita Ram so much. They're there. There? A lot? Or?
Yeah, a lot.
A lot, yeah. But the most famous temples in South India are generally Lakshmi Narayan or Vishnu. Yeah, Tirupati.
Shiva. Shiva worship.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. That's another thing. Yeah, the southern India is based on Vaikuntha worship, which is mainly Lakshmi Narayan or Vishnu. You see in Tirupati, what are the other famous temples? Srirangam and many of the Adikeshava temple, like that. All the famous temples down there, Gururai, all those famous. It's mainly Lakshmi Narayan or Vishnu worship, which means the mood is towards Vaikuntha, whereas in the Golda Desh, or the northern part of India, Radha Krishna worship is much more prominent, Sita Ram worship, so it's a different mood of worship compared to what's there. So it says that that tract of land in that northern part, it says very auspicious. It's a very auspicious tract of land. Like that. And the southern part, that is also very auspicious. But the mood is different. And the prasad is different. Like that. No, just like if you go to the southern part, what do you eat? Ili dosa utapana. And if you go northern, what do you have? Roti, poli, kachori, gujarati. Different. The prasad is different. So the mood is different. The prasad is different. The cultures are quite different. The South Indian Vaishnavas have a particular culture, a particular style of worship, and a particular mood of worship, and a particular type of prasad. Whereas North India, it's a very different mood. Prasad is different, the mood is different, the culture is different. It's very two different types of, broad types of worship. But both are Vaishnavas. But just the mood of the Vaishnavas is a little different, because the goals are a little specialized, a little different. That's why Lord Chaitanya was a Gaudiya. And then he travelled to South India. And he would tease the South Indians. Why does your Lakshmi come to my Krishna? He would tease them. Say, why does your Lakshmi come to my Krishna? You're worshipping Lakshmi, but she comes to my Krishna. He would say that to you, tease them. So the mood is different between the two areas. So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, he says that the northern India is very auspicious, that tract of land between the Himalayas and the Vindhya mountain, which means those northern states, Punjab, Gujarat, Rajasthan, Uttar Pradesh, Madhya, across to Bihar, across to Bengal, like that whole tract. During the months of January, February, and March, oblations offered to the forefathers are called Ashtakar Shraddha. The Shraddha ceremony is held during the dark fortnight of the month. When Maharaj Ikshwaku was performing his oblations in this ceremony, he ordered his son, Vikukshi, to go immediately to the forest to bring some pure flesh. Thereafter, Ikshwaku's son, Vikukshi, went to the forest and killed many animals suitable for being offered as oblations. But when fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful and ate a rabbit he had killed. Sri Chaitanya Prabhu.
It is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest because the flesh of the animals was suitable to be offered at a particular type of yajna. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the ceremony known as Shraddha is also a kind of yajna. In this yajna, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. However, in the present age, Kali Yuga, this kind of offering is forbidden. Quoting from the Brahma Vaibhav Purana, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, in this age of Kali, five acts are forbidden. The offering of a horse and sacrifice, offering of a cow and sacrifice, acceptance of the order of sannyas, the offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and the man's begetting children in his brother's wife. The word Paitrakam refers to an offering of flesh in oblations to forefathers. Formerly such an offering was allowed, but in this age it is forbidden. In this age, Kali Yuga, everyone is expert in hunting animals, but most of the people are Shudras, not Kshatriyas. According to Vedic injunctions, however, only Kshatriyas are allowed to hunt, whereas Shudras are allowed to eat flesh after offering goats or other insignificant animals before the deity of goddess Kali or similar demigod. On the whole, meat eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to eat meat according to various circumstances and injunctions. As far as eating beef is concerned, however, it is strictly prohibited to everyone. Thus in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna personally speaks of Gorakshilam, cow protection. Meat eaters, according to their different positions and directions of the Shastra, are allowed to eat flesh, but never the flesh of cows. Cows must be given all protection.
So what are the points?
In the previous ages, you had to show valor. You had to eat, Shudras are allowed to eat insignificant animals, or otherwise you had to hunt yourself. You show the valor and the courage and you hunt yourself and you eat. But nowadays, the way they just gather cattle and they treat them, it's really competitive. There's no valor or anything.
Yeah, and even the Kshatriyas, Prabhupada mentions they would go and kill the tigers, but they would either kill with the dagger or with their hands or with the bow. Like that. These days they just go with a gun. You know, it's very easy to kill anything with a gun. So, any other points?
We consider cow as mother.
Yeah, she's special. Amongst all the animals, the cow is special. Amongst all the animals, it's one of the particular features of Vedic culture. They don't understand this in the modern day. They think all the animals are equal, but the cow is always revered. It's why in India we say holy cow or sacred cow or like that. It's a different animal altogether. Many important properties from the cow, which the modern society they don't understand actually. They think we're sentimental. They don't understand the connection. Very powerful connections between cow worship and many parts of society. It's more important than what people realize, actually. Any other points?
Muslims eat cows, so is it ingrained in the Quran and how they what is the basis for them to take cows, like meat cow Muslims?
Oh, Muslims?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe in the Quran. I'm not sure. I've never read the Quran. I don't know if it's mentioned. They're allowed to eat the cow. It says in the Quran they can't eat some meat. I don't know if it says cow meat or not, but anything else? No? So we see in the Bhagavatam it's saying everything must be regulated in human society. You see here specifically Prabhupada answers. They don't just eat any meat. Meat eating is there, but it is very, very controlled. Like that. And the civilized people don't eat. Prabhupada said that of the five Pandavas, because the Chachuris are allowed to eat the meat. You know, they go into the forest, they kill the tiger, they're allowed to eat the tiger's flesh, the Chachuri, in order to increase their own strength. But Prabhupada says that the four brothers, they did not eat the animals. Only Bhimasen. He would sometimes kill a tiger, and sometimes then he would eat the flesh after he killed the tiger. But the others did not do it. Even though they were permitted to do it, but they would not do it. So generally, civilized people, they don't touch meat. Because it's not palatable. Like that. And it certainly cannot be offered to Krishna, so it's not prasad. Devotees are interested in prasad, so they're not interested in eating flesh. For the sudras and that who cannot give it up, then they have to, you know, as the shastras say, they can kill the goat. But you can't kill any goat. It has to be a goat who has like a black spot on him, or he's a black goat, and has to be on the Amavasya, and all rules and regulations. Can't just eat any goat. It's once a month. It's very, it's like sex life, once a month. Right? Same thing, then eat the flesh once a month. It's not like you can just eat it any time you want. Very, very strict. So then why would you do that? If you go through all that and you still want to eat meat, then... Any other points?
Why do they offer their flesh to the ancestors?
The forefathers. It must be some particular ceremony. I'm not familiar with it. I haven't done it in this temple.
The forefathers don't...
I'm serious, I haven't done it. So. Yeah, like, I can't tell you, I can't give the answer, because I've never done it, and I don't know what the procedure is. I've never seen anyone do it in this one, so. There must be something there, it must be some Vedic thing, where you offer flesh to the forefather or something. I don't know if it's just to the Kshatriyas, I don't know what it is. No idea. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the details are. I don't know the answer. And if you paid me lots of money, I still wouldn't do it for you. I don't know what the system is. I don't understand it. It's something we don't do in Kali Yuga. That's why it says in Kali Yuga you don't do these things. Yeah, in the previous age, obviously there was something there. I mean, Vashishtha himself, who was a brahmana, he's taking the flesh and he's about to offer it. So there is a system. I don't know what the system is. Maybe they bring the animal back to life. I don't know what it is. Okay.
I gave Mahaprasad to my forefathers.
You gave Mahaprasad?
To my forefathers.
That's good. Good. Did you give any to me?
Yeah. Sorry?
Did you give any to me?
You. I'm talking about forefathers.
I'm talking about me. Did you give Mahaprasadam to me? That's what I said.
No, I didn't give you, but you are
That is what I'm interested in. Okay. Take it. Vikukshi offered the remnants of the flesh to King Ikshvaku, who gave it to Vashishtha for purification. But Vashishtha could immediately understand that part of the flesh had already been taken by Vikukshi, and therefore he said that it was unfit to be used in the Shraddha ceremony. So, nice purport. So we'll just read that. Mitesh, you want to read that?
The heart which is meant to be offered in yajna cannot be tasted by anyone before being offered to the deity. In our temples, this regulation is very well, so that they may be saved from committing offenses in deity worship.
Yeah, so Rupa Goswami mentions there are 64 offenses in deity worship. So we have to understand what are the offenses. You can never taste anything which is to be offered to the deity. Even if you look at it with the intention of thinking, oh, I will enjoy that, that's actually subtly, it contaminates the offering to some degree. That's why it says whenever we take the offering to the altar, it must be covered. Because as you come through, people will see it, and they'll see, oh, that is bhoga, which is meant to be offered to Krishna, and they'll think that is for my enjoyment. It actually says, the nectar of devotion, Rupa Goswami says in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that if you're taking the offering, and an animal, like a dog, sees it, because a dog cannot control his senses, and he sees the offering, you cannot offer that to the deity. So you have to understand these points. So there are important things. So for us, none of us will take the offering and taste it before it gets offered to Krishna. Right? None of us would do that, because the reaction is extremely heavy. But we should not even think it. That's the whole point of deity worship. It's on the subtle platform. Right? We're meant to train our mind to think when we cook the offering, this is for Krishna's pleasure. When we do the jagya, we say, idam krishnaya, idam na mama. This is for Krishna, it is not for me. And on Janmashtami, you know, quite often I chant this mantra. Because my service in Janmashtami is to make the offerings for the deities. To get all the offerings and to put it on the plate and then take it to the deities to offer. So then, quite often on that day, I chant this mantra. Idam Krishna, idam na mama. This is for Krishna, it is not for me. Because that is what we need to learn in our consciousness. So that it's an offense to taste something before it gets offered to the deity. Even to think it is an offense. Which verse is it?
9.
When King Ikshvaku, thus informed by Vishishta, understood that his son Vikukshi understood what his son Vikukshi had done, he was extremely angry. Thus he ordered Vikukshi to leave the country because Vikukshi had violated the regulative principles. Having been instructed by the great and learned Brahmana, Vashishta, who discoursed about the absolute truth, Maharaj Ikshvaku became renounced. By following the principles for a yogi, he certainly achieved the supreme perfection after giving up his material body. After his father's disappearance, Vikukshi returned to the country and thus became the king, ruling the planet Earth and performing various sacrifices to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vikukshi later became celebrated as Shashada. The son of Shashada was Puranjaya, who is also known as Indravaha, and sometimes as Kakutsta. Please hear from me how he received different names for different activities. Formerly, there was a devastating war between the demigods and the demons. The demigods, having been defeated, accepted Puranjaya as their assistant and then conquered the demons. Therefore, this hero is known as Puranjaya, he who conquered the residents of the demons. Puranjaya agreed to kill all the demons on the condition that Indra would be his carrier. Because of pride, Indra could not accept this proposal. But later, by the order of the Supreme Lord, Vishnu, Indra did accept it and became a great bull carrier for Puranjaya. Well protected by armor and desiring to fight, Puranjaya took up a transcendental bow and very sharp arrows. And while being highly praised by the demigods, he got up on the back of the bull, Indra, and sat on his hump. Thus he is known as Kukutsta. Being empowered by Lord Vishnu, who is the Super Soul and the Supreme Person, Puranjaya sat on the great bull and is therefore known as Indravaha. Surrounded by the demigods, he attacked the residents of the demons in the west. There was a fierce battle between the demons and Puranjaya. Indeed, it was so fierce that when one hears about it, one's hairs stand on end. All the demons bold enough to come before Puranjaya were immediately sent to the residence of Yamaraj by his arrows. To save themselves from the blazing arrows of Indravaha, which resembled the flames of devastation at the end of the millennium, the demons who remained when the rest of their army was killed fled very quickly to their respective homes. After conquering the enemy, the saintly king Purunjaya gave everything, including the enemy's riches and wives, to Indra, who carries a thunderbolt. For this, he is celebrated as Purunjaya. Thus, Purunjaya is known by different names because of his different activities. The son of Purunjaya was known as Anena, and Anena's son was Prithu, and Prithu's son was Vishwagandhi. Vishwagandhi's son was Chandra, and Chandra's son was Yuvanashwa. The son of Yuvanashwa was Shravatsa, who constructed a township known as Shravastipuri. The son of Shravasta was Brihadashwa, and his son was Kuvalashraya. In this way, the dynasty increased. To satisfy the sage Uttanka, the greatly powerful Kuvalayashwa killed a demon named Dundu. He did this with the assistance of his 21,000 sons. O Maharaj Parikshit, for this reason, Kuvalayashwa is celebrated as Dundu Dumara, the killer of Dundu. All but three of his sons, however, were burned to ashes by the fire emanating from Dundu's mouth. The remaining sons were Dridashwa, Kapilashwa, and Badashwa. From Dridashwa came a son named Hayashwa, whose son is celebrated as Nikumpa. The son of Nikumba was Bahulashwa. The son of Bahulashwa was Krishashwa. The son of Krishashwa was Senajit. And the son of Senajit was Yuvanashwa. Yuvanashwa had no sons, and thus he retired from family life and went to the forest. Grantara Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.